This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Despite many adjustments since 1925, Cincinnati has been a council-manager form of government. Council sets the policies, but those policies are translated into action on the ground, as well as a myriad of operations of an organization with 6,000 employees and a budget of $1.5 billion. By the city manager. Although Patrick Duhaney stepped into the city manager's office on an interim basis back in April, the mayor and council removed the acting title about a month ago. We are joined today by Cincinnati's 16th city manager, Patrick Duhaney. If you would like to join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Manager Mahaney, thank you for joining us today, and congratulations on getting the acting part of your title off that title.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It can be I've been an interim in several situations, and that can be a little bit awkward. So anyway, let's start on a very personal level. You were born in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. When did you immigrate, and did your whole family immigrate?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. I think I came from Jamaica in the early 90s. And it was my father, he came over first and set the groundwork. And then he came up for my sister and me. And then shortly thereafter, I think probably like around 94, 95, 96, can't remember all the dates correctly, my mom came up as well. We were initially in New York and we ended up moving to Cleveland, Ohio. And I went to high school in Cleveland. I graduated from Cleveland. And from there, I joined the Army at 17. And then I did a couple tours in the military. I was in Iraq for a period of time, and then I ended up here for grad school.
At DAP, right?
Yep,
School of Planning.
School of Planning in 2007. Okay. And then I interned with the city in 2008, and in about 2009, I got my first stint in city employment in Milton Dahoney's office, in the city manager's office, and I was a contract compliance specialist. I did that for a couple of years. Then I went to go work in the private sector. I went to go work for LISC, Local Initiative Support Corporation. I did that for about 2.5 years.
Really engaged in neighborhoods.
Definitely. I was in Price Hill, Avondale, and Madisonville, and also in Covington across the river.
Mm-hmm. So when you were in the Army, mm-hmm. what did you do there? I've heard various things.
So, all right. I initially started out in the Army as an electrical systems repair, but when I ended up in Iraq, I was double slotted with another person, and then all of a sudden they told me, well, detonation systems, electrical systems, all the same thing. So I did a lot of on-the-job training for putting out IEDs and things like that.
That sounds pretty dangerous.
Yeah, it has its moments.
It has its moments. And did you do that before you became a fully naturalized citizen?
Yes. Yeah, I became a citizen shortly after I graduated grad school. So I became a citizen in 2009, and I was in Iraq and Afghanistan as a permanent resident, a green card holder.
So you know that the current administration is mm-hmm. trying to restrict the number of people who aren't full citizens from mm-hmm. joining the Army. Mm-hmm. Was it – that was something that was important to you? And what would you – how do you think about that?
And I think it's a disservice because to me that was my gateway to the – to success, to a career path, for schooling, and to kind of like pay back my dues for coming to America and getting this great opportunity to be a part of this country, because no matter what, it's still the best country in the world, and I have several cousins that came from Jamaica, and I think it was about 4 or 5 of us all went to the military around the same time. And it was our way of like breaking into the middle class, and we didn't have access to student loans because we green card holders. We didn't have access to certain kind of benefits as it relates to kind of like paying for school. So that was really a great opportunity for us to kind of get a craft, get a career, and also pay for school and set a pathway for a career.
So once you came out of the service, you had access to the GI
Definitely.
Bills and support for college and mm-hmm. graduate school in your case.
Yes. Yeah.
So what's the thing mm-hmm. as city manager that you think the average citizen, most citizens, don't understand about what you do?
I think what people don't really understand is having a job where everybody think they can do it better than you. You know, like, I think I love going to the grocery store and somebody pulling me aside and they tell me how they can improve trash, you know, or how they can deploy snow plows better than how we currently do
very
it.
Very timely.
You know, so to me, it's like, I love that because, like, you in order to navigate that, you got to be very humble and you got to listen to it because, like, these are your boss's bosses, right? I got 10 bosses, the mayor and 9 council members, and the citizens are their bosses. So I got to be very open to constructive criticism and feedback, you know, because how we deliver service to them depends on the outlook and they feel about the city, you know, and in turn, how they speak to my bosses, you know? So, like, I'm very open-minded listening to their feedback, you know? And I think that's probably one of the toughest things to navigate. And probably similar to how elected officials feel is that when you're in the community, you know, you're the people's, you belong to the people, you know? So they definitely aren't shy about letting you know how they feel about certain services or certain services that are not being done in the city.
How do you think you did with mm-hmm. with clearing snow this time?
This weekend, I mean, our public service department rocked it out. They did an awesome job, especially considering that around 4 a.m. Sunday morning, the sky opened up and just dumped like 4 or 5 inches, you know? But I think considering where they came from and how recently, you know, what they've been doing, especially with the new change in the department head and the new climate that's over there as well, they did a phenomenal job. You know?
Good thing it was a weekend.
Yes.
That helps.
I think that's what we said that too as well. It's like, thank goodness it was a Sunday.
That's right.
You know, can you imagine if it was a work day?
Yeah,
you know?
I can imagine. When you became the acting city manager back in April, that was right on the heels of the Kyle Plush mm-hmm. tragedy. Now that we're, 8 months past that, mm-hmm. how do you think the city and what measurable things could you point to that the city has done to respond to that situation and improve that situation?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, as you said, that was right after the situation where Kyle Plush lost his life. And I think that broke the city's heart. You know, I think the city is one of those things that happens and then you reflect on it and it really changes the culture and it changes the mindset on how you approach the job. And I think now if you look at where we were statistically at our 911 center, it's night and day. You know, call answer times is not really it's not the only measure that we have, but it's one of the ones that we track. I think last year, this time, we were somewhere at around 70% of them being answered in 10 seconds. Now we're like at 95, 96, 97%. The national standard is 90. So we're consistently exceeding the national standards. You know, staffing is being stabilized. You know, we've added a training section, you know, that's focusing on continually improving staff, bringing them in, teaching them on the technology. You know, like, we're totally night and day from where we started. And I think a prime example of that is what happened on the 5/3 night, you know, the day of the 5/3 incident. You know, our officers were able to respond to that tragedy so quickly because all the ducks were in a row with the call takers and the dispatchers and getting the information out to the police and communicating with the citizens and telling them to hide in place and to duck and cover. You know, that was a phenomenal point of time for our 911 call takers. And it really kind of helped them reassert the value and the need that they, the role that they fill within the city.
And there was a 911 operator who stayed on the line with a woman who was hiding, right?
Definitely.
Just across the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when something like 5/3 happens, mm-hmm. what do you as city manager do? I mean, you're not a police officer mm-hmm. who can necessarily run to the scene. What do you do in that situation?
I think my job there is really quarterbacking it. You know, like, first is like listening to the police chief, the fire chief, figuring out what resources they need beyond what they currently capably already have. It's basically staying in touch with the mayor and our 9 council members so they understand what's going out, you know, ensuring that the proper flow of information is getting to the media so that the right accurate information about the project is going out as well. If there's any kind of emergency purchases, transactions that need to happen at that time, if something's missing or something's needed, it's my job to authorize that, you know. But basically, like you said, the primary role of that is in the 911 call center. It's on the police department. It's on the fire department. But it's my job to make sure that they have everything they need to be trained and get up to speed, everything that they have, all the information, technology, and the equipment that they need to do the job. And then my job now is to quarterback it and relay the information to my 10 bosses so that they can adequately provide information to the public. Yeah.
the Plush family has stayed on this. They don't, you know, they are constantly saying, we haven't solved this. We need more. Two questions about this. What's your personal, do you have a personal relationship with the Plush family? And have you tried to help them through this situation? And secondly, what still needs to be done until you feel like we've gotten to the right place?
Yeah. And it, I would say, I wouldn't say it's a personal relationship, but I communicate to them as much as they're willing to communicate with me. You know, so we, I definitely reach out to them as we are get ready to present on the 911 center and on the Law and Public Safety Committee. We've met about three or four times over the summer to discuss the incident, to discuss where we were in terms of the investigation that we presented, and also to hear them out as it relates to technology and also some continuous improvement stuff. You know, to me, their strength is remarkable. You know, to go through such something that caused such a dramatic pain to them and their family, and to still be on the forefront of this thing and keep making this the main thing, you know, is really phenomenal. And it really helps make sure that we are keeping the ball moving and we're moving in the right direction, you know. So we definitely are in awe in the strength that they display.
You admire them rather than feel like they're pushing you too far.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And can you really say that somebody is pushing us too far when it comes to probably, if not the most, if one of the most important functions of the city is that when they call 911 center, people expect people to take all your information, to respond and get there and take care of you in the worst time of your life, probably.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. We are joined today by the new Cincinnati City Manager, Patrick Duhaney. If you would like to join the discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You've mentioned several times about your 10 bosses, which of course gets mentioned all the time in the press as if you're just torn in 10 directions, and we'll throw in the general public as an 11th that you were talking about. People may not know, if they haven't been at City Hall, the manager's office and the mayor's office are in the same area right across from each other with a common public area. What's your day-to-day interaction with Mayor Cranley?
I think my day-to-day interaction with Mayor Cranley is we communicate a lot, especially as it relates to anything that may become public, you know, anything that is a touching a key priority initiative of his, you know, and definitely we meet frequently. Like we have usually one set standard meeting to start the week, and then we close the week with another meeting to debrief on the important issues that happen, you know, but we meet a lot. We communicate a lot. We communicate a lot during the day. Like last night we were on the phone during the incident with the I think it's the Parks Lane off of 4200 Brick Deer Parkway. There's a four-alarm fire.
A fire, yes.
In a period of time, I think there was a firefighter that was trapped in that, and I communicated that to him as well. So we were really in prayer and, like, communicating back and forth with the fire chief to make sure that incident went the right way. And it turned out that everything was perfectly fine. The firefighter was safe and no loss of life, and the building was damaged, but nobody lost their lives. So that was the most important thing.
Yeah. What about relationships with these nine city council people? How hard is, and we all know that all nine city council people aren't on the same page all the time. So what, how would you describe that relationship that you have to build?
I think the best way to navigate that is just to be truthful at all times, right? You know, I'm not a politician. I'm not good at politics. All I do is just, I stay true north, you know, and I treat them all the same. I respect the authority, the rank, and the title that they have as council members and the powers that the people instill in them to represent them, you know, and I just treat them all the same. I stay true north. I share all information to all of them. I keep their strategies and initiatives and agendas secret and sacred and don't share them amongst other people as well. It's just really affording them all the respect that they are entitled to for the position and the responsibilities that they hold for their different constituents that put them in that position.
Because of the configuration, I can see interacting on an almost, sometimes you can have formal meetings, but casual conversation about exactly the right thing at just a moment when you're passing. I can see how that happens mm-hmm. just with the mayor because you're in the same space.
Yeah.
Council members are up on the third floor. Mm-hmm. You have to go look for them.
Yeah.
Or they have to come down looking for you, which mm-hmm. I'm sure they do. But is that a little bit harder?
Yeah. And also, a lot of times I'm not the only person that has to communicate, you know. So, like, I have assistant city managers. We have department heads, you know, and they are also talk to the council members as well. You know, usually council members don't go below the department head level. But department heads, if there's a particular issue that a council member has as it relates to a project or a priority program or a citizen's concern, they're free to submit information to council members to address their concerns. And a lot of times, John Jewick, assistant city manager, and Sheila Hill Christian, my other assistant city manager, they play an important role in making sure that council priorities get met and that they get communicated to as well. And a lot of times when there's issues that come up during the day with a particular item or issue, I pick up the phone and I call the council members and update them or brief them or answer any questions that they have.
One of the issues that has emerged just recently as a very public issue that's on people's minds is the question of pedestrian safety, mm-hmm. particularly as it relates to school children.
Yeah.
Tremendous number of pedestrian accidents, some deaths, mm-hmm. some very serious injuries. You're a city planner by yeah. background. Mm-hmm. What do you think is how do we have to approach this?
Yeah.
And what role can you play? There's going to be a lot of the elected politicians who are going to have their idea of what to do. But how do you bring something to this that brings order and purpose?
Yeah. So I think a lot of what we're doing right now as an administration is gathering all the data. You know, so we've recently surveyed the community to get a sense of what they feel like are the priority hotspots. And also, we have a lot of radars and traffic gathering information out there in the community and stuff, technology out in the community. And we're looking at all that now to identify the hotspots as it relates to where the data is saying is the most volume, the highest rates of crashes, the highest rates of incidents. And then from there, we're going to bring it into our stat process and then evaluate it to kind of figure out how best to approach and prioritize the top 10 issues and then go down from there. A lot of it also is we really need to get funding, you know. So like we got $500,000 approved last year, in last year's budget, and we've spent that already, you know. So we kind of need to get more.
We're only halfway through the
definitely,
budget,
yeah,
budget year.
Yeah, so we need to look towards getting more. We've pushed on the police department, and they've been very tremendous partners as it relates to trying to figure out a way to get some more enforcement out there. You know, and one of the incidents that recently happened, we actually did have an officer out there that to provide an enforcement, and the incident still happened as well. You know, but they've went through a blitz in, I think, the month of November and December and issued a plethora of tickets, you know, so like, but it's not just enforcing it out. You know, we're a big city. We have a good sized police department, but we don't have enough police officers that we can have somebody on every street at every single time, you know, so.
Well, you never can. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of theories about mm-hmm. traffic slowing,
yeah.
traffic management, safer mm-hmm. intersections.
Definitely.
There's a lot of theories out there that other cities are using. A
yeah.
lot of cities are using the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. IoT, mm-hmm. To gather data in real time.
Yeah.
And does Cincinnati need more of that?
Yes. And if you look at other, like our sister city, Dayton, they recently rolled out traffic cameras, you know, and they were able to reduce their pedestrian safety accidents and car crashes in key and hotspot intersections by 20%, 15%. You know, if you look at what's going on in New York and their Vision Zero, one of the things that they were able to do was deploy 140, 160 traffic cameras in Manhattan to really curb down some of the issues with pedestrian safety.
Can we use traffic cameras here?
No, we need a charter amendment, you know, but I really think that's one of the things that we're going to recommend that the mayor and council take a look at, because we can't deploy enough police to really enforce this out, and we don't have enough money to engineer it all out.
You know? Moving up through your mm-hmm. career with the city, you were with the Department of Sewers, mm-hmm. sort of the city's version of Metropolitan Sewer District, MSD. This is one of the biggest issues on the plate. You know, who owns MSD? Who runs MSD? It's the federal courts are involved. It impacts the pension question. Where are we on this, and what about resolution?
Mm-hmm. So I think the last thing we've heard is that OPERS is not going to
make a change. That's the state retirement system.
The state retirement system is not going to make a change to allow county SOAR employees, if they ever transfer to the county, to stay in the city's retirement system. So I think the transition's on pause right now. But we're still operating the SOAR department. You know, we're still making sure that the system works, that it collects, and that everything is sanitized and everything is treated appropriately and goes into, you know, the rivers in top grade quality and stuff like that. So I think that stuff is playing out in the background, right? But the SOAR system's still operating. You know, we're still managing our responsibilities as a city. And
how long can that go on, though, in this sort of unclear way, because the compact between the city and the county is over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a point at which something has to happen?
We need a political solution for that, you know, but I could tell you, as long as that's going on, the city's going to maintain its responsibilities to operate in the SOAR system.
So you're there day by day. Definitely. On the operations side, which is the point I tried to make at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that not just you, but earlier city managers have brought up in every budget cycle,
mm-hmm,
is the question of, should the city collect all of the real estate tax that it has the right to? Ever since 2000, the political decision,
mm-hmm,
by the elected officials has been to roll it back so we only collect $29 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
You encouraged again this year that we collect the full amount, which would add about $2.7 million for the rest of this year or whatever,
mm-hmm,
the first part of the budget cycle, and twice that ongoing. Is this, I mean, given a $19 million budget deficit we're facing, where does logic play in this, and mm-hmm, where does politics? This is really a rough thing for the people we have to manage.
Yeah, and I think we take the guidance and direction of council. You know, so council decided to roll back to the millage that brings in $28.9 million. You know, but we're going to have to make some tough decisions this year, you know, and I think everybody always says, oh, yeah, we always say it, especially since now we're entering into negotiations with our unions. They say, you always say it's a tough budget, but I think this one is going to really be a tough budget in that we've exhausted all the administrative creativity that we have as it relates to moving things to other funds appropriately, you know, and we've increased permit fees and parking fees a lot. You know, I don't think we have enough bandwidth in the community or support or even room to actually move those up any further. You know, so now I think administratively we're out of options other than looking at which programs we need to prioritize. And when you look at this, our city and the pie that is our budget, you know, over 2/3 of it is police and fire. And then you throw in ECC and that brings it to about 70%. And when you bring in public services, there's not much room to cut, you know, because you can't cut the core services that the citizens depend on. Yeah.
Well, we've got a couple of questions that, mm-hmm, have come in as the show has gone on here. One is from Peter, who's asked, what will you do to strengthen the relationship between the city and the neighborhoods?
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things, I think that's probably Peter Hames.
And he, yeah,
yeah. So he was in my office last week and me and him had a discussion. He gave me some ideas on some of the things that we can do as it relates to making sure that when we work on our projects and different initiatives that we bring the community in up front, you know. So I asked him to kind of point out to me projects where he feels like we dropped the ball on, and I'm going to look and take more of an initiative on it as well. So definitely we can do some of that stuff in our capital projects, you know, bringing the community in as we move to design and engineering phase, you know, and then definitely some other key priorities. And one of the early wins that we can definitely have is that every time we communicate about something, about a specific neighborhood event or a specific policy that's going to impact the neighborhood, so definitely share with all community councils. That is something that we're working on right now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. One quick last question. Scott actually sent this in on our Twitter. Is there a way to charge a $5 per airplane ticket for everything that goes through CVG for the next 25 years to build a light rail system between CVG downtown and the I-71 corridor going north?
That's a tough question.
Wish they could see your face.
Yeah, ooh, I'm not sure, but I'm definitely somebody can look into it. But it may be something more for the FAA or something like that. But we could definitely look into something like that.
Okay, mm-hmm. These are the sorts of things that get at a whole cluster of questions that mm-hmm. I could want to have a discussion with you sometime about, which is regionalism and how we interact as a region, mm-hmm. and because without that. This question is really hard.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being here today. Congratulations on your new role, and good luck as things move forward. And just stay in touch. And I'm sure Cincinnati Edition would love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.